what's the point of measuring something submaximal? Like, we're not going to do 20 meter fly runs every session. We're not going to be maxing out the gym, whatever it is. So organically within the training program, there are opportunities for athletes to explore, like, I guess, some of the more subjective things, like around how your foot feels hitting the ground when doing some intensive tempo running, or perhaps how does your body feel manipulating postures and torso angles when doing resisted acceleration runs when you don't have the spikes on and you just have your flats.
That was Jack Edwards, and you're listening to the Just Fly Performance Podcast. Today's podcast is sponsored by Team Builder. You can get a free trial of their training portal software by heading to teambuilder.com, and you can use the code JUSTFLY for a 30-day free trial. Sign up today with Team Builder and see what they can do for you for your training programs and your team. Welcome to another episode of the podcast. Thanks for tuning in. Our guest today is sprint coach Jack Edwards. Jack is the coach and company co-founder of Track Speed Development and is experienced in club and high school track and field coaching. Jack runs the Metamorphosis Track Project page on social media, and he works closely with individuals from diverse backgrounds and age groups, ranging from national level sprinters to newcomers in track and field. It's easy in sprint training or general athletic performance to get locked into an isolated aspect of coaching all athletes the same, expecting the same response from all individuals in a training program. And although there's certainly group factors in training, to grow as coaches and in the athletic process, we need to learn about and respect those individual parameters in performance. On today's show, Jack will talk about painting a picture of each athlete based off the driving mechanisms of their movement, their structural and strength abilities, and their unique response to training. He'll be getting into this and much more on speed and athlete development in today's episode. I really enjoyed this conversation, and I'm excited to get to the show. So let's get to episode 409 here with Jack Edwards. Jack, it's awesome to have you on the show here. One of the posts you made that I found intriguing, because it's, I guess, one of those pendulum swinging type posts, is it good, is it bad, is ab circuits, like just doing ab training or abdominal training circuits after a sprint session or a workout. What are your thoughts on that? Useless or helpful? Or maybe it's too polarizing. Just what are your thoughts on that?
I mean, the ab circuit thing for me is sometimes when I get a little bit lost in the sort of coaching thing, and I sometimes reach towards the classics, and I don't know, would have just probably reading some old Charlie Francis stuff. And I just started banging it out, just classic crunches and leg raises for time, push-ups, all those sort of body weight calisthenic exercises on off days. And I don't think it was useless whatsoever. I think that the demands of sprinting and lifting weights and getting jacked is such a stressor on the posterior chain. And I kind of, as someone who has some anterior hip issues historically, I almost felt like the ab circuits were my postural restoration, as silly as that sounds, and just sort of moving the spine after it gets jammed up from, because I do like back squatting and power cleaning and bench pressing, sort of like your classic strength and power exercises. It sort of felt like a restored balance to my physique, to be honest.
Yeah, the whole... Yeah, it's easy. It's very easy to poke holes in anything. And I think any exercise out there, you mentioned back squats or whatever it is, I think you can always find something that's negative and something that would be a positive. Like if it's an ab circuit, you could just say, oh, well, if you do higher up ab circuits, you might end up in anterior tilt or something, and you're reinforcing a bad pattern or whatever. And yeah, I could definitely see that. But I've seen a lot of athletes doing high rep ab circuits, and it's really not that often you get people in that like hyper cranked extension to hyperflexion. It might be like a more of a like a minor level, but there's also it's a circuit. It's like bicycles and oblique abs and side to side, all sorts of different things. I think you can also make a straw man of, well, it's just a bunch of sit ups and you're just letting your back get in a bad position. And I say all this, I have a few stories. I'll just keep it very brief because I'll just say just one very quickly is I was at that place where I probably would have thought high rep ab circuits were not the way to go. When I first started as a strength coach at Cal, I mean, we did like some medicine ball higher rep stuff that actually, yeah, you said Charlie Francis. When I was at Wilmington, we finished a lot of weight room sessions with like a Charlie Francis style higher rep med ball ab circuit type thing. And I was like that. The athletes always liked it. You do it with a partner. We might have done a few abs, but it was more like leg raises, stuff on the bar, ab wheel, whatever. And then I remember working with swimming at Cal. At first, the coaches did the deck dry land where you're just like, you know, on mats on the side of a pool, basically. And it's basically like abdominals type stuff. And it was very high rep abs. And I was pretty judgmental at first. But then in going through the years and taking on that deck dry land myself, I realized two things that stood out is one, swimmers like doing that because they like feeling like their abs are tight. Like you could say the same thing with like a pec pump. You do a high rep set of push-ups or something like that. You like, totally. There's something psychological that's very positive about that feeling of tightness, be it, the pecs or the arms or the abs. And if you feel good, the mind and the body are so woven. You know, there's that. There is, there's absolutely what you said as well. Like the process of basically giving more sensation, movement quality, balancing forces in the hips itself. And then I also had an athlete, an Olympian, someone who was a gold medalist who said that the day after doing higher rep abdominal work, where he was just a little sore from it. I don't think my abs are so sore, but like he felt it a little bit. He always remarked that was a positive for him in swimming. And I thought, wow, maybe there's like a sensory piece, you know, like you worked your abs, you maybe feel good from that. There's that good feeling that kind of remains. It's obviously not enough to harm your swimming. And maybe there's also maybe a little more sensation there due to the fatigue. I don't know. But I think it always goes further than just pointing out that one or two negatives, like, oh, it's bad movement quality, it's endurance, it's your back's in a bad, or whatever, you know. And I think the circuit can mitigate a lot of that. Like your original post was ab circuits, not just do push-ups, you know, or sit-ups till you can't do them anymore.
Yeah, and I think that if you're like me, Joel, who would train every day as hard as he could, if it was permissible. So kind of finding variety on days where I should probably be taking a chill pill is also something valuable to me. I think that there is something like psychological, as you said, about getting a pump and very few other spots on the body which feel as good than getting an ab pump. I always like the Bouchex-Nader bodybuilding circuits because I'm sure there is sort of endocrine support generated from doing those circuits, but I do think that there is also a psychological element to it. And to your point about that sort of feeling of tightness, maybe it's also a reflection of the type of athlete that I am who enjoys tone in the anterior chain, because I can also sometimes feel and perform better when there is some tightness in my quads as well. It may be a personal thing, but I don't think ab circuits are useless. And perhaps the lens which I used to view high rep ab training through, like how's it being overloaded? You know, what are you really getting out of it? What adaptations are being made through the ab circuit? Joel, I can't really tell you exactly what's going on there, but the byproduct is that you feel pretty fantastic and some of the stress from that you need to undergo to become a powerful sprinter seems to be mitigated for me personally.
Yeah, in some ways, I think this wouldn't have to be like a direct classification. And as soon as you get into like the mental side of training, and especially any mental side that has to do with toughness, there's instantly like a million ways you can go with it and a lot of wrong ways you can go with it. But I do think I've started to toy with the practice of putting some things in the program and intentionally saying they have nothing to do with sets, reps, time, output. And it's 100% just for mental, psychological well-being or working through something mentally. And those almost are always basic muscular exercises. Like, doing a set of push-ups in the morning and you're not counting, the only thing you're going for is the maximal like pec pump, which I think has a really powerful boost in psychology. Richard Achavis, who was on this podcast a while ago, had talked about that and talks about that. And then another one is like a horse stance or something like an isometric. And really just being mindful of the stages your body is going through, not trying to like fight it. You're not going through like, oh, I'm going to go as long as I'm going to do 5 minutes and fight the fatigue and get tough. Not like that, but more like keeping your breathing going and noticing the stages your body goes through as it goes to flow to more like a fight. It's like, when is this turning into a fight stage? And then how do I respond to that? And an awareness piece. And so, sorry, that's a little bit of a rabbit trail on my end, but I more say it just to speak to the, sometimes I think just when things feel good, that means a lot more than I think coaches traditionally have given that value. And it's a barometer too. I think Austin Yoakam was recently on talking about like play having a profound impact on the prescription. And I think sometimes looking at things that just feel good, we can use that as a little, like a little trail, not a rabbit trail. That's the wrong word. I'm trying to think of something that Rick Rubin said recently on a podcast. But basically, like it gives you a little path, you know, to explore. Well, why is this feeling good? Where can we go with this movement? And why does that feel good for an athlete?
I can't say I like transcend to the same levels that you do, Joel, on this sort of thing. But for me, I just like, let's bang them out, catch a sick pump, have a hot shower afterwards and appreciate what's going on sort of thing. It's pretty good.
Yeah, no, you're definitely right. Because for me, this is how I go through things in my personal practice. This is not how things get communicated to the athlete. That would make for a very long and confusing practice. But it's kind of like, yeah, that ends more of my personal thing to be like, okay, how could I put this? Is there something I could adjust in the program that might go with this? So, but just how you answered that, and in your posts, I could see you're someone who really values like balance in a program, for lack of, I guess, for the easiest way to put it, in the sense of you could tell an athlete, well, run with your knees as high as you can, or run with your knees, not that anyone says it, but run with your knees as low as you can, or run tall. Well, what does that mean? How tall should I run? Do a bunch of abs, or they're useless. And it seems like as I've read through your work, I really appreciate the mindful balance and then how that's communicated to the athlete. And so my next question for you here is, what's your take on, let's just say, working through those sprint variables? So like knee lift, for example, or hip height and running. How do you look at finding the sweet spot for the individual athlete in those situations?
I think that my goal when I first start working with someone, I guess, is to try and paint a picture as to who the athlete is. And often I think when you sort of leave someone to sprint without really giving any advice about how they should sprint, you'll more than likely get a manifestation of their general physical qualities. And so you can start to hypothesize really what does this athlete present. So when I first start working with someone, I don't really give any particular hard cues. Even if I have a technical model that I want to shift them towards, I kind of need to understand whether or not this technical model is achievable for the athlete. And so as soon as possible, we'll try and do some really like basic testing, which gives an idea about, just their general power, strength and power qualities, perhaps their range of motion, their elastic qualities. These things sort of have nothing to do with sprinting in themselves, but I think that oftentimes that these sort of like qualities are really systemic in nature. And if someone is to, for example, run with really high knees, that may be reflected in the ability to generate high, vertical forces. If someone's got really, if someone lands their foot well in front of their center of mass, perhaps they're a heavier athlete who requires more ground contact time to create propulsion. So I think that balance is sort of achieved by gaining as much information about the athlete as possible. and then seeing how that filters into the sort of technical model that I aim to achieve for that athlete.
Yeah, I love that answer. And I think that so often the answer is just a little bit more awareness, isn't it? Like, so often, a lot of times it's like coaches have the thing in their head that they want to do or very early on versus, like you said, just watching an athlete run without any cues or anything, or even like even predispositions, because I think a lot of times an athlete's been told something, like maybe they've been told run tall, high knees, dorsiflex your foot. And you can see when they run, or especially when they skip, like they're really trying to do it because they know the coach is watching, and they're gonna really push that envelope. But and sometimes with those athletes, then it's like, okay, well, watching them play an ultimate frisbee. Okay, how do you run an ultimate frisbee or something? Or how do you run when you're playing football? But yeah, I love that answer because I just think that I don't think we spend enough time just watching athletes move and understanding how they are trying to solve the problem. And to make things athlete-centered, I think there's more time that's needed for that before all the cues come out. And just
I agree. I don't really know how someone can give advice if they don't really know the full context of who this person is. It sort of is based upon assumptions. And when you start sort of providing all of this, you know, technical advice or maybe even with programming implications and things of that nature, if you're basing it upon assumptions, it's just luck if they make significant improvements, or it's just luck if the program suits them. I think that there are probably like common factors which need to be included in the program and the sort of movement styles that athletes probably need to move towards to become faster runners. But yeah, I really, as you sort of outlined, Joel, I do value the process of observation based on I don't know, you probably have seen it when someone rolls in for the first time, you ask them to sprint and like sometimes it's full on red flags. I think something bad might happen here. Things are exploding. They're heightened. But for the most part, people know how to run, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I totally agree. Even before I pushed record, I know I was talking a little bit about watching my children grow and how their running form, which I'm obviously not saying anything to them about how they should run, just watching how they solve the problem of running as they grow and learning through that. Like, it's a huge learning process for me. And I just think it's so easy for coaches to, they already know what they're going to coach. They already know, like, they have the model and they're going to just steer all those athletes from that model from day one. And it's even before they even, like you said, see the sprint for the first time, it's already in the warm-up. You're going to sprint like this. It's in all the drills. And if you could give a few examples of like how you would observe and then where you would go with that in either direction or just a few sample directions.
Yeah, so I guess a bit of context is probably necessary as to, I guess, the athlete cohort and the coaching environment that I work in. And it probably will make no sense to people in the US because, I'm just like a club. I'm just a club coach. And we have, I guess, athletes who are running at national level. We just had nationals last week, which is why I'm kind of like on an athletics high a little bit still. Mm-hmm. We have athletes coming into the door who've never run in track and field. We've worked with field sport athletes, teenagers, people who've had kids, people in their 40s, people who are 15. And we, because myself and Dr. Mike, who's like my co-coach, company owner, we've got other jobs that we work as well. So everyone trains at the same time. So we've got a national level 100 meter sprinter, you know, 400 meter sprinter running next to a guy who plays rugby league. So I think that that in itself is really powerful because it can sort of freak out some of the team sport athletes, for example, if they're warming up alongside someone who can come close, you know, around 11 meters a second when their sport demands they probably don't maybe even go over 8 meters a second. So they might adopt some of those things before I even say anything, which is powerful. But when working with an actual sprinter, I guess we sort of have, we give them an extremely cookie cutter basic warm up. There's no sort of trial process, which we get them on a table and start assessing them or anything along those lines. They do a warm up with everyone. We try and pair them up with an experienced athlete or someone who we think is social enough to take someone under their wing, and they copy the drills of the days, they copy the jumps. We don't really ask for our athletes to give other athletes technical feedback or anything on those lines, but it sort of means that myself and Mike are able to stand back and watch how they navigate the whole situation socially and technically. And then it's not something which becomes apparent immediately as to who this athlete is, but it becomes apparent over time as they're exposed to a really varied training program. So as you said, I kind of like balance in the program. We don't really go down a route of complete, we're not just sprinting. Athletes need to be doing general power exercise, jumps, throws, heavy lifting, more ballistic lifting. So I think a practical example perhaps where athletes are provided sort of different technical feedback is we've got an 18-year-old guy who was trying to make sort of like the semi-professional rugby league team recently. He's 18 years old. He's probably 100 kilos, 220 pounds. And when he was just doing his acceleration, for example, he was trying to adopt the sprint technique of the national level sprinter next to him. So he was obviously driving his head into the ground and collapsing as he sort of overstrided and crashed because he overswitched. So we sort of encouraged him to obviously have a less aggressive torso lean to try and keep his strides organically increasing in length by not going as low in shin angle and torso angle. Because his body can't facilitate an elite sprinting technique. So that's, I'm not sure if that's sort of what you were leaning towards there, Joel, but similar, the exact same feedback would be given to a 15-year-old girl with a dancing background who doesn't have the force production capabilities to facilitate. You know, it's like working with kids. Kids will never look good. Accelerating it will always look garbage. So I guess it's going to, because it's not strong enough to do so. So trying to put them in, you know, situations where it looks good, but I guess changing the cueing depending upon their physical qualities and where they're at in their physical development. And I guess most of all, I'm trying to encourage each athlete to form their own athletic identity. We're all sort of blessed with our own natural gifts. Some people, I guess, are going to be more naturally strong. Perhaps, you know, our anthropometry varies greatly. And an example is this girl who I coach who ran at nationals last week. She's a short little Lebanese girl. And we're talking about how do we take our sprinting to the next level. You're short, you need to be a master of acceleration. Your tibias are not long enough to be like, you know, Elaine Thompson. We need to look like you, a Sabota, and own that narrative and own that athlete identity, because that's sort of what we're being given. And yeah, and sort of, I think once athletes form their own identity, they can become more confident in competition, more confident in training, because there's a clearer objective about what they need to accomplish.
Today's podcast is sponsored by Lila Exogen Wearable Resistance. Exogen is used by coaches such as Randy Huntington and Chris Corfist and is an incredible tool in overloading the angular momentum and speed aspect of human movement. You can get 25% off of Exogen sleeves by heading to lilateam.com and using the code JustFly25. Yeah, I love that with the athlete identity. And as I'm continually trying to work through like this, I guess it's a very generalized term, but the athlete-centered model. And that is, it is giving the athlete something to look at, and in the sense of, well, where do I go? Like, what, based off my strengths, like you mentioned with your sprinter who didn't have the long tibias, like to give them an identity, but also like, who do you watch? You mentioned a sprinter. It's like, they're just trying to copy the technique of the person next to them. And what I found, and as I've started coaching high jump again in high school track, what I've been doing, especially for the kids who are really into it, they have goals. They want to jump in college. I find jumpers that are basically like them. And there's so many jump types. I mean, you have all sorts of different body types and heights and leg lengths, and you have more speed jumpers and power jumpers and different ways athletes approach the penultimate, all these things. And so for me, it's fun to give athletes, be like, hey, watch this jumper and how they jump. And it's like someone who's like you, but they're jumping, you know, a foot and a half higher. But it gives them it's a lot better, I think, than being like, okay, well, here's just all the technical pieces, and you need to do this. And Paul Kader had mentioned it recently, just the value, and I've heard it from more people than Paul since the episode I did with Paul, but the value of mimicry. And instead of things just being completely technical, like, oh yeah, practice is just coaches' instructions the whole time, giving athletes a few athletes to watch that fit with their own identity that they can be inspired by, and just letting that process run, and not necessarily, especially if it's an athlete who's going to go and watch those individuals versus the typical way we think, where everything, absolutely everything, is just a coached and instructed process.
I got even more abstract with that when I was working in high school, and a really popular show on Netflix at the time, and it's played one of my, I love animation, like I love The Simpsons and like everything like that. And a really popular show on Netflix at the time was a show called Avatar: The Last Airbender. Have you watched it?
I haven't, but I've seen a lot of like, I don't know if memes is the right word, just like clips from it that fit with training. So I definitely, I definitely get it. Oh yeah, you did post that a long time ago. That's probably why it's largely in my head. Yeah.
Yeah. And it, you know, to this point about communicating athlete identity is, I was working with at a all boys school, and we're coaching a variety of different athletes. And like the one thing I really wanted them to get out of the training experience is sort of like to be proud of their strengths and to understand them as well, and to not have shame about what they don't have, so that they'll continue to push forward in their athletic endeavors. Because, you know, if we're doing a sprint session, you know, there might be a rugby player, there might be a sprinter, there might be a swimmer, and they all present different strengths. And I always linked it back to this show because every kid at the school had watched it. And in this universe, it sort of, I guess, is roughly based in China, I guess, ancient China. You know, it's an American animation, but and there are four nations, and there's earthbenders, there was waterbenders, there's firebenders, there's airbenders, and they all presented very different skill sets in combat, you know, and in attitude as well. The earthbenders, very stoic and tough and strong, and they can't be moved. And the firebenders were a bit feistier and more explosive, but extremely destructive, and can perhaps overstep the line. And the waterbenders are smooth, and the airbenders are rapid. And I think even beyond just giving them athletes to look at, it was really easy for me to say, like, you need to be smooth, like a waterbender.
That's awesome.
Explosive like a firebender, or if a rugby player, like a prop who's going to be like a bigger boned kid, is next to like a little greyhound, I guess it's comforting for the earthbender child to understand that in a rugby scrum, this airbender has got absolutely no chance against him, even if he's going to lose in this 20 meter run. And so, I really buy into athlete identity, because I think it paints a path for success. And we all have a very different path for athletic success.
With the Last Airbender too, something that I've thought, gosh, I've probably started like three of these with something I've been thinking about. I think about a lot of things, but something that's interesting to me is not just, and this comes from coaching like youth sports. I just did like a wilderness, like a nature games thing for a local elementary school yesterday, which was, I felt, was kind of like flying the plane while I built it, honestly. But it was fun. But through all that, and then kind of reading nature education, something that is critical to working with any child or youth athlete, who's young enough where their imagination is still really going, is like a sense of wonder. And I think we very quickly, once we reach adult training, forget about that entirely, as well as like the meaning behind things. Like, and what I mean is, I don't know, like I think there's part of training that if you think of yourself as a superhero, and I know Rafe Kelly in Evolve Move Play, like that's one of his, I think, taglines, is like becoming your own superhero. And there's just, and with that, there's that little bit of a sense of wonder, like the same thing you get watching like a superhero movie or anything like that. And you had mentioned you were an English teacher. That's your background. And it reminds me a little bit of Nick Winkelman. And he had written, I think it was one of the books for Human Kinetics, that his chapter was like a story. It wasn't like coaching. It was like coaching, but that was a story. And I think we don't value those things enough. Things that are story, things that draw a sense of wonder, things that you can get meaning out of that isn't just direct coaching or technical models. Again, I'm talking a lot about like, okay, things that aren't coaching. I think those things absolutely have value coaching. It's like, I've said it so much. I'm like almost making this story that, yeah, don't coach, just show people like videos and stories and, you know, and whatnot. And that's all you need, but obviously it's all important, but I hope you know what I'm saying. I just think that that's to draw different parts of the story of the athlete through those ways, I think is so valuable.
Yeah, I guess there's really no point in having the world's greatest system if it can't be effectively communicated and be meaningful to the people that you're working with. Like that avatar example holds pretty much no meaning with the athletes that I'm currently working with. Like they're people in their mid-20s and they're not as like childish as myself, I guess. But for those like 13, 14, 15, 16-year-old boys, it resonated.
Yeah.
Yeah. And instead this, you know, when I'm working with sort of older athletes, it's still just as valuable, but perhaps, you need to sort of make a conscious effort to understanding, I guess, why they're doing it. And, you know, not for myself with like an English teaching background, I sort of this year embraced a little bit more of my creative side in communicating some of these things through presentations, funky, like unlisted YouTube videos, which I'll send to our group squad and stuff like that. And I think that at least that effort, maybe they're just like, this guy is so sad in making this, but at least he's trying his best. But there was bought in, there was a bit more buy-in, and that was more effective in creating better results for my athletes.
Yeah, as you were, and that was something I was actually going to follow up with is, just like Nick Winkelman would say, starting a coaching session by just asking athletes, like, what are you interested in? What's your favorite movies? Or stuff like that, where you start to understand what they like and what's meaningful to them, and then you could build analogies around those things. But yeah, like you said, it depending on who you're talking to, be it, yeah, teenage boys or older athletes, I was actually trying to find this here, is I swear Noah Lyles had something kind of like an avatar like depiction, or I'm trying to, maybe it was him or someone else.
I think he loves anime. He loves Naruto and stuff like that. Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad you confirmed that for me, because I was trying to, I was like, I swear he loves that kind of thing, but I was trying to look at him and find it. So it's like, you know, there are those adult athletes who that is part of, like, that is meaningful to them. But I guess it makes me think, and this is something that would be a total beginner at, but for those 20 somethings that's not a big deal for, well, is there something that might be, like, or even for me, like I watch a Rocky movie and it pumps me out, like the old school ones, like the training in Siberia and stuff and whatnot. Like I just love that. Like, and like what, I guess what story is deeply meaningful to an athlete who is a little bit older, you know, and not like you have to make everything around that, but it's an interesting thought to consider at least, or what type. Everyone loves like the what type are you quiz, like that kind of thing. I'm sure it could be,
oh totally,
yeah, scaled to pretty much anybody. What type?
I get obsessed about those things, like everything that you've brought to the floor with like all the neurotyping. Even that avatar typing was based off Ross Jeff's like concentric, you know, elastic fascial type athletes. And then unfortunately earthbenders didn't make the cut to be a sprinter, but that's fine.
What you said? Are you an earthbender? I forget if you mentioned.
I think I'm like an earthbender converted into a firebender, and then it just oscillates depending on how much bench press I'm doing at the time.
Yeah. Earth, that's like more muscle, right? Like, I don't think the old Poliquin elements, like his depiction of the earth type was like Arnold Schwarzenegger. Like, they're very like grounded, a lot more muscle, like oak, you know, the oak type thing. Whereas the fire is like, was like the power lifter in his thing, where it's just like, you know, all neural nervous system, or the sprinter or whatnot. So what's the water? Cause I think water has kind of been associated with emotion in a lot of, you know, circles. What's the waterbender in the Avatar?
If I can kind of like make it, but to go back to sprinting, I guess, well, like fire would be like Coleman, you know, air would be like Andre de Grasse, perhaps, and water would be like Alice and Felix, where there's sort of like the metabolic component, perhaps sort of really good at energy return. Reese Prescott is another guy who comes to mind for water. They kind of move a little bit differently. So fluid. Ben Johnson, Christian Coleman, Carl Lewis has probably got a little bit of everything going on, but yeah, I guess on this conversation of identity and narrative and story, I think it's cool. It's the fact we're talking about it for like 25 minutes probably or something like that. It's an engaging and important part of coaching, in my opinion.
Yeah. Would like Harry Akins be like a fire who converted to earth? Like you said, your earth converted to fire. Is he fire convert? And that probably happens to a lot of like college football players and things. Fire converted to earth, and you're the opposite with sprinting.
Yeah, he was probably like a fire straight out of the womb, and then had dad strength chucked on top of him, and he's become an earthy sort of guy.
Yeah, I do think that would be an interesting like way of approaching it. Like sometimes I was thinking about, someone had just posted this recently on Twitter. It was like a number one wide receiver in American football who only ran a 4.6, like 4.65 or something in high school. And then after 4 years at a power five school, strength and conditioning, ran like a 4.7. And so like that would be like probably someone who's like more of a fire, maybe some other things, right? And then definitely put more earth on. But I just like that, because I think just outright sometimes telling people in like, if you outright told all the strength coaches in those programs, well, you need to not value strength so much and mass so much, because what about the speed? And maybe, I don't know, maybe there's a story that could frame it a little bit differently to them that gets the mind working in a different way. So I just like the categorizations too. I think it's fun to, I could do categorizations all day, probably to the point of detriment and imbalance, I would say.
Yep. I probably became so neurotic that I made my own, which is comfortable and probably not many people can relate to. So,
yeah. I like how you put you related to the Ross Jeffs though, because to me, like the water, like kind of the fluid, it's almost like the working creatively with what you have, like way of producing or assisting in producing speed is an interesting way of putting it, for sure. Something I know I do want to get to this before I think we, before our time's up here today, I want to spend some time on this one, because to me, this is a big one, and it's something that's very easy to do in modern training, which is like looking at the micro heavily, like all the little factors, like you could say things that come out of force velocity profiling or just step characteristics. You know, what's your maximal force zero, and everything on the micro level, versus the macro. So what was your sprint time? What was your global technical pieces and things like that? So the, and how can those two work well together? How do you look at one in light of the other? I'm curious what your thought is on some of those pieces.
But I guess if we're in the context of sprint performance, I guess like the most important thing, I guess, is how fast are we running? And how fast we're running is going to be dictated by stride length, stride frequency. So everything, I guess, in the training program is looking to optimize that equation, I guess. But as far as micro versus macro goes, with the cohort that I work with, where none of us are looking for, none of us is sort of making a living by creating a 1 degree change in shin angle, or you know, like 1 centimeter closer in hand width around the blocks. Mm-hmm. You know, it's typically the macro side of things, and I'm probably just repeating myself from before, and I keep on trying to get my athletes to focus on the big picture about what is going to actually create a change in their performance. So, because it's sometimes the temptation for the athlete and the coach to try and look for answers in places that they don't exist. Like sometimes athletes, and I see it often where athletes who have stagnated in their ability to produce more power and more force will try and like change their block setting, or they will try to do something differently with their hands, or they'll try to adopt a movement signature of a famous athlete, when in reality, like, their counter movement jump just might not be good enough to get effective block clearance. And so to go back to sort of some of the previous questions, I try to paint the broadest stroke of the brush about who this athlete is. And as long as we can kind of figure out some of the big pieces to address, whether it is, I guess, physical development, or if it is technical development at various stages within a race, these are the things which I'm becoming increasingly relentless at addressing, as opposed to looking for the small pieces. And sometimes I can really aggravate my athletes because they'll come to me with hypothesis about their hand positioning, or trying to manipulate like their arm swing, like how much elbow extension or flexion they may get. And then sometimes I just completely shut it down and remind them about some of the bigger rocks that we're trying to address.
Yeah.
It's I don't know, I'm probably the really annoying to work with sometimes because I don't entertain it enough.
Yeah. Yeah, it's an interesting question, because I think there's certainly value in those data points, absolutely. But then there's also that, well, what's the balance? You know, how much of working based off of data points versus based off of the whole thing and the feeling associated with the whole thing? Because I would say feeling associated with the complete performance, or even like, you know, even if it's like a 60, if it's a 100-meter dash, it's your race, and it's a 60 or 40, the running a 40 or 60 and the feeling associated with, to me, are a lot more global things. And so, yeah, it's an interesting interplay between them both, for sure. I like how you mentioned too, like, athletes who they're not running as fast as they can. I think this happens a lot. Yeah. And it's like, okay, well, the solution, well, it must be just a technical thing. It must be just, well, I need to mess with my blocks, or I need to try this different technique out of the blocks. But like you said, like their vertical jump, the raw power that contributes to zero step speed is just, it's just not there. And the ultimate solution for that, in that sense, is, well, you just need to get more powerful. And that's something I remember I was at, this will be a little different than some of the other ways I've started these thoughts, but I was at the zoo last year and I was watching kangaroos jump around. And I was just thinking to myself, what would it be like to be in the body of a kangaroo? In the sense of, like, and I also think about this sometimes, is you see a really powerful athlete and you think to yourself, imagine you were in that athlete's body, and how easy it would be to hit some of these positions and to do some of these things that you're trying to do, versus, well, no, you're in your body. And so how can you make things the best for your body right now? And ultimately, it's sometimes it's just upgrading the neural wiring, and it's not messing around continually in the blocks, or it's just, you know, just learning to compete and just going through the training process a little bit better. But it is interesting, the rabbit trails we can end up on to try to find. Yeah, it's like, what's the process of finding that next level?
Yeah, I think perhaps to, like, another perspective on it, I guess, is that, like, within the training program, I guess, for me at least, not every session is like quantitatively, not quantitatively measured, because But, you know, it's almost a blessing out of logistics or timing, or perhaps just the athlete population that I work with. We can't do something worth measuring every single session, because what's the point of measuring something submaximal? Like, we're not going to do 20 meter fly runs every session. We're not going to be maxing out the gym, whatever it is. So organically within the training program, there are opportunities for athletes to explore, like, I guess, some of the more subjective things, like around how your foot feels hitting the ground when doing some intensive tempo running, or perhaps how does your body feel, you know, manipulating postures and torso angles when doing resisted acceleration runs, when you don't have the spikes on and you just have your flats, or perhaps, you know, sequencing exercises in circuits and things of that nature, where perhaps we do like a dribble into like a straight legged run into just a 50 meter or 60 meter run. And so, although that there isn't really like a, you know, because we're not measuring that time on that day, you know, we're not really looking at it as an assessment. And I guess competition falls into this as well. But it's organically, most sprint programs, I think, will have an opportunity for athlete exploration to, you know, explore rhythm, to explore some more subjective things. And oftentimes they'll bring these experiences into the development of those things that really matter. Like, if I want an athlete to increase their, like, maybe their ankle is at efficiency from an elastic standpoint, one of the best things that an athlete can do is go run a bunch of like 150s at a submaximal tempo, in just runners, not in spikes. And they can actually feel like that full foot landing. They can sort of feel like the ankle and the toes sort of rolling over sometimes, or perhaps they slap it a little bit more. So I'm not sure if that sort of goes back to your point, Joel, about what really matters within the micro and the macro. I think that my perspective is that the macro needs to be constantly addressed and observed and assessed, but perhaps some of the micro is explored through other training modalities which aren't on the same level as the things which are observing in maximal intent training methods.
Today's podcast is sponsored by the Plyomat. The Plyomat is not only an unbelievable jump testing device, being able to gather counter movement jumps, reactive strength, as well as custom tests, but it also is an incredible training device and will add that extra dynamic to your plyometric sessions. You can link multiple mats together, so if you're doing depth jumps, hurdle hops, bounding, single leg hops, you can get contact times, reactive strength. You can flash it up on the screen as athletes go through and add that extra element to that performance training session. To check it out, head to plyomat.net. That is plyomat.net. Yeah. Before I get to my thought, I love the 150s thing with the elasticity, just because that's kind of it's a macro way of building foot and ankle strength. And I think the micro way would be to get into, you know, all the nitty gritty pieces and where there might be some deficiencies and things like that. But if the foot's working decently well, yeah, running a 150, like, and for me lately, one of the things I've been programming this and loving it, and even just doing it more myself, is 150s with different feeling emphasis. So not even just time, but like, hey, I want you to run this 150 and feel, just make it feel good, make it feel really easy. And I'm not even going to get the time, or maybe I do, but it's like, how fast can you run it? Just making it feel like the easiest, smoothest sprint in the world, or feel the bounce in your feet on every step. Feel the snap of your foot and ankle off the ground every step. And I was watching Kevin Mayer sprinting. I think it might have been a slow motion, just a strider he was doing. He may have been barefoot, I'm trying to remember, but Kevin has one of the longest like stride lengths ever. And a lot of decathletes have stronger stride lengths than 100. But like, speaking to like kangaroos, if you watch his foot in the takeaway, I don't know that I've
seen... He plantaflexes it so hard.
Oh, so it's hard. And not only that, but there's like a little like, not like a reverb is the word I want to say, but like there's a little like oscillation even in the toes. Like, people can't see it because I'm like just oscillating my finger back and forth. But there's like the same way you would crack a whip or watch the even the takeaway maybe of an animal like a cheetah, where it's just like snaps off the ground so fast, there's almost like the foot's along, the toes are along for the ride, and they're just kind of like oscillating in the back. Like that kind of thing. Anyway, it's like pasting that even on to like searching for that feeling in a 150. I'm not saying everyone needs to run like Kevin Mayer. He, you know, decathlete, he has his own needs and he's found his own strengths in his unique way. But I do think that that feeling from the macro carries a lot of value. And so, yeah, the 150s thing, like super resonate with. I think there's a lot of power in that. And all of it does make me think, I was even just going back to the idea of like play versus prescription. In some ways, I would lump the macro in with play, just because the macro, there's a lot more there. There could be competition, feeling, meaning, like it's something that you can't atomize as much. And like the thought almost being, I think sometimes maybe it's more about the direction in a way. Like in one way, you could say, all right, well, here's all the micro, here's your assessment, you know, here's all the little pieces, now let's make the macro out of it, versus looking at the macro and maybe looking at the technique and the feeling from the macro, and then maybe looking at, well, now what micro piece do we go to, or what assessment in the micro could we go to? What could we learn from the data in the micro? I don't know. Like I'm just kind of run. I know people debate this, and so this is how my mind's processing it. But yeah, I think there's a lot of ways to go for sure.
It's funny because you and I think had flipped understandings of macro and micro, where I thought macro was like, you know, all the numbers, the power stuff, and the micro was the finer details. So I think even that speaks to, I guess, just like how where like different people's minds can go with this kind of thing. Because I don't really get too caught up on how other people approach this, because I think like there's been too much variety in the success of athletes in history. Who's to say the way I view it is correct? You know, it's just the way I like to do it. And I think the main reason why I sort of view it through the lens that I view it with is because I think that with the people who I work with, they're just like really glaring deficiencies that could make significant improvements if addressed. And that's what's happened. You know, like I'm still at the stage with the people I work with where sometimes the answer is getting stronger, but that's not going to be the case for very long.
Yeah.
It's not going to be the case for elite athletes. It becomes increasingly nuanced, and greater critical thinking and maybe more creativity and more variety, more competition, whatever it may be, is probably more necessary than just more strength, more power. Let's run more speed, blah, blah, blah. But that's just where I'm at the moment.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with the getting stronger. It does only help for so long. And then you do have to start to get more nuanced and creative in how you go about it. But I was thinking about with like the, yeah, it's funny that we switched the terms up with that. But I was thinking even about like something that's more like zooming out. Hank Krienhoff had talked about, I think it was Nelly Kumin, how everyone's like, whoa, well, Nelly, who was just like a 60 meter fire plug. And everyone's like, oh, she's got to improve her speed endurance, and that's going to be make the difference. And then they spend all this time improving her speed endurance or something like that. But the net of the whole thing was then her acceleration and that whole piece got messed up to the point that she didn't go any faster. I think she might have actually gotten worse. But you could zoom in even further from there. You could say, okay, well, there's even more acceleration variables, or there's more top speed and speed endurance variables that you could. I think there's more variables that we have, I think, more in the acceleration world. I think there's less, at least right now, with top speed and speed endurance. It seems like to me that's almost still something that's a little more intuitive and creative how it's coached.
Addressed.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think with my, it's a great point. Like sometimes it could be really tempting to like look at a rate limiting factor, improve on it, come back to sport or performance or whatever it may be, and sometimes even see negative transfer of the intervention. And I guess it's because the improvement of that variable is based upon the assumption that in isolation, reinserting it into a complex system will reap improvement, and that everything almost remains untouched and uninfluenced. But it's not the case typically. And then when it comes to, I guess, yeah, and to your point about speed and speed endurance and stuff, I think speed endurance, the simplest way, in my opinion, to address it is through competition.
Yeah.
Like, it's just the outputs, you know, go unmatched. Beyond just like the sort of metabolic demands of sprinting, like, there's an accompanied psychological stress, which can only be challenged through racing against a complete random who's probably faster than you. And I haven't seen the transfer from speed endurance training. When I say speed endurance, I'm thinking like 70 through like 120 meters. So like that red hot sizzling speed endurance training. The transfer of that sort of stuff compared to racing itself, it seems to be incomparable.
Yeah. Yeah, I would agree. It's interesting, yeah, to think about the, like, the just the stimulation that brings that out. And even how athletes, even like the state of the mind with that stuff, when you're racing somebody and trying to hold on and outdo somebody versus if you're just racing for the clock, what's going through an athlete's mind at that point? It's like, okay, what's the technical piece I need to keep bringing up here? What did coach tell me? Like, how do I do this? You know, versus like, you know, that thing that, not that I think that, I think that that part of the rehearsal can certainly have value, but I think it's also interesting to notice for athletes almost in their own bodies to notice what their body is doing in that competition to, with like the increased stimulation, kind of like with what I talked about imagining you're in a more powerful athlete's body or an animal's body. You know, sometimes I've been in competition. Javelin throw is something that really, this was like the biggest competition booster is when I was throwing, like if I threw like 50 meters, 52 meters, that'd be a pretty decent practice day. But then I'd go to competition and like, I would feel like my body was getting ripped apart and I'd be throwing 60 meters in warmups. And I was like, what is going on here? Like, what, it's like I'm in a different person's body right now. And so, yeah, I've always kind of been attuned to some of those things that change when you have some of that competition adrenaline and what that, and then how your body decides and chooses to use that in that moment. So probably.
Yeah. Like if we're running like 80 to 120 meters, people, you know, like a lot of the athletes will talk to me afterwards, like, I don't know what to do once I'm at speed. I don't know. Do I relax? Do I keep trying hard? And after a competition, that question is never raised. Like, I think there's a solution has been found. And I don't know, I haven't really ever thought of it like that before. As I said, with the adrenaline, in season training is like very reactive in nature because of that exact reason. Like, we don't really, like, I can wake up the next day after a competition and it's like someone's scraped all my hamstrings and hip flexors in a way in which, as if I hadn't been training for the previous 6 months. And I don't know why, but I guess that's my stance on speed endurance competition.
Yeah.
Beats all.
Yeah, it is a beautiful thing. It's basically like, yeah, it's like extra like nitrous oxide dumped into the system to give you a new experience. And I remember when I was playing basketball in high school, I would be lying down in bed after like a tough practice or open gym or a game, and I would look at my calves and my calves were just like twitching. Like there was just fibers still twitching. And there's, that never happens anymore, really. Like I could do all the single leg line hops and try to recreate all the stimuli of playing, and I could get a great training stimulus without question. But it takes that competition and like all the little variability and the however many thousands of ground contacts that were so many of just chasing explosive and task based to bring something out of the body. And I remember I watched watching some of my dunks from high school in a dunk contest and compared to 3 years later when I wasn't playing basketball, like in college. Like I basically went from being almost completely four-footed, like kind of toe dominant in a way, but getting up off the ground extremely effortlessly, like head almost up to the rim on a reverse dunk at 6 feet 1 inches. And then in college, not playing, lifting a lot more weights, doing way more squats, and just being way more flat-footed, like total transformation in a way. So it's, and it's not just, but I think you would say, well, it's not just the training, it's also the competition. It's also, what do those competitive pieces take out of you? And then when you do go to train, how can you make it as much like that as possible? And yeah, that's something that I've been thinking about with that as well. And I think, but that's where those 150s, I think, are important, because it's like when you're running them, it's not just an exercise. It's like, yeah, this is kind of tough too. You know, you run enough of them, there's fatigue that builds up. There's something that's emotional to it at some point. Like there's like a feel aspect of it as well. And a lot of, it's just something that I think on the macro is really powerful. So, yeah, those 150s, competition in 150s, I think are, yeah, macro things that are really powerful.
The things that really take your mind to special places that that you can't really get elsewhere.
Yeah, for sure. Well, Jack, it's been great talking to you today. Where can people find more about you and what you do, as well as, I think you have some sprint training, like educational material out there. Anything you want to share with that before we finish the show?
Yeah. I mean, the best place to find me is at Bankstown Athletics Track in Sydney, but online, Metamorphosis Track Project is my Instagram handle. I do have a single program called Acceleration Monster, which just is a real basic guide to, I guess, some of those big rocks of how to be a good accelerator. But yeah, if you go to my Instagram page, you'll find random blogs, everything from my thoughts on various anabolic foods to avatar sprint typing. You'll find a whole lot of variety of things there. It'll be atypical, but I'm pretty open to have a chat online. I really appreciate you having me on, Joel. It's been a blast.
Yeah, it was great talking. Thanks for being here today, Jack. Thanks for tuning in to another episode. I appreciate you being here, and I'll see you next week.